Hi, my name is Jen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 1st of 2000. Midtown's my home group, and Joni D. is my sponsor. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come down. It's an honor to do anything for AA. And, a little nervous. Hurts a little pounding right now. But we'll see what comes out. Usually, right beforehand, I try to pray and say, God, please speak through me, because I don't want to, like, start thinking of what to say and how this is going to come out. And so here we go. Basically, I grew up in South Carolina for the first 10 years of my life. When I was about 3 years old, my mom is originally from Alexandria. My dad was from South Carolina, so we would always go back and forth for Christmas. And we would, like, you know, stop at Shoney's, and that was, like, the highlight of my trip, going to see the monuments and everything. And when I was around three, my parents decided that it was a good idea to start giving me alcohol. Just because, you know, my uncle had a really bad problem, and they didn't want me to get addicted, so they were like, well, we'll just start you off early, so that way you won't like it. And every time I drank, I was like, yeah, this is gross, I don't want any more. Yeah, this is gross, I don't want any more. Ew, ew, ew. But I'd always ask for another sip, every time without fail. So from the age of three, I had the phenomenon of craving, which is kind of odd. But so my mom grew up in, you know, like a heavy drinker household. No one in my family besides me is alcoholic. But my uncle and I did have this kind of like relation to each other. Like, for example, we were at Christmas dinner and I had asked for the butter. And he looked at me like, no, I'm not going to pass it. I was like, pass me the butter. He was like, no. I was like, please pass me the butter. He was like, no. My grandma was like, stop it! Stop it! I can't deal! And it was like this, you know, this unspoken relationship that we had with each other. Like, we knew we were messing around. We knew we were joking, but my grandma just couldn't handle it. So I really believe that. He actually died of excessive drinking when I had 2 years sober. So I really believe that he did have a problem. And that's why my mom was so highly affected by it, because she had seen my grandpa drinking, she'd seen her brother drinking, she had dropped him off, and so that was where I kind of came in, and she was like, well, I don't want my kid to be like that either, so we're going to start her off early. And basically, as a child, I was pretty isolated. I lived 20 miles outside of a small town, so there were like 9 houses around a pond, and the alligators that swam in the pond and the snakes and the turtles, they were all my friends. You know, I had no other friends because no one wanted to do the hike. You know, it was 20 miles outside of town, so no one wanted to come out there. And, you know, I was kind of picked on as a kid, too. Like, when I was in school, people would always make fun of me. And I never really understood why, because my dad owned a car dealership, so he had, like, a pretty decent life. You know, my mom worked for him, and I couldn't really understand why I was picked on when there were people that had, like, lesser circumstances than me. You know, like, their parents didn't have jobs, or there were, like, 15 kids or something. Like, I thought that I was okay, but at the same time, like, I always felt so beaten down. I always felt so made fun of, and I was the kid that could never come up with a comeback. Like, you know, the your mama jokes? I could never come up with anything, so I'd sit behind a tree and cry, because I just couldn't come up with anything. So that kind of led me to isolating more, but I did all the normal stuff. Like, I did ballet, I was a Girl Scout, I sold the most cookies because my dad owned the car dealership, so he forced people to buy them. And my parents both loved Girl Scout cookies, so they would just buy cases and keep them in the house for the year. So I did, like, pretty normal childhood stuff. And, like, when I was younger, I would just walk around in the woods, and I would pretend I was Sleeping Beauty, walking through the woods, waiting for my prince to come. Because for some reason, I always had, like, these idealistic hopes that something better would happen and something better would come along. But it never really did. So I would just, you know, go in the woods, and I'd start singing to the birds. I'd say, come here, little birdie. And it would fly away, and I'd start crying again because it flew away from me. And just a plug, Sleeping Beauty's coming out soon. I got really excited because I'm that self-centered. And so that was pretty much my childhood. I mean, I was raised in a fairly normal family. My parents seemed to be happy. They fought a lot, but normally it was after I went to bed. And I spent a lot of time with my mom. There was a lot of codependency there because my dad wasn't really around a lot. He came home at 6 o'clock, turned on the TV, watched the news, went and ate dinner, my mom would stay in the kitchen and clean the dishes, and then he would go sit back in the recliner and watch TV until bedtime. So that was pretty much, like, my childhood was just watching him, like, doing all this, watching my mom cleaning. And, I mean, they never really argued or anything, but they seemed like they were decently happy. And when I was 9 years old, actually a little bit before then, my mom had been talking to me about it, and she asked me, do you want to leave? I was about 8 and a half or 9. And before then, I had been sent to Florida to live with my grandma so that they could kind of duke it out without me there. Because my mom really didn't want me raised in a household where they yelled all the time and they were fighting, and she didn't want me to be around that. So she sent me to live with my grandma when I was in fourth grade. And they reconciled, so I came back, and that's when she asked me, do you want to leave? Do you want to leave your dad? And I had this crazy idea in my head of what would happen to me if I stayed in South Carolina in this small town. Like, I would have 4 kids by the age of 14, with one on the way, married to the gas station owner. Like, I had this crazy idea of what my life was going to be like. So I said, sure, let's go. Because I'd already been up here, you know, I already knew what Virginia was like. And even at 8, I knew there were much more opportunities available to me. So I left with my mom, and that night, the night before we left, was one of the last times I saw my dad until I graduated high school. I was at my friend's house playing, and it was like literally across the yard, and he called them and told me to come home, and he asked me if I knew, and I told him, yes, I know that we're leaving tomorrow, and he said, why didn't you tell me? And at that point, like, my allegiance was pretty much with my mom, because we had that codependent relationship where I just looked to her for everything. And, I mean, my dad and I would go swimming and stuff, and we had our activities, but it was really my mom that I was connected to. And I just looked at him and I was like, I don't know. I can't tell you why. And he was like, well, you'll always be my little girl, and I'll always love you. And that was one of the last things my dad said to me before I didn't see him. So the next day, you know, we drove up to Virginia, and we lived with my grandma for a while. But before I started fifth grade, I went back down to see my dad one last time. And it was like a big family party. It was like a welcome back. We're glad to see you. You know, we want to see you again kind of party. And my half-sister was there, my aunts, my uncles, my dad's first wife was there. And my half-sister at the time was pregnant, so she didn't want her drink. So, and I also had a friend there from town. It was, like, my only friend that I had that I was still, like, writing letters back and forth to. And so my half-sister didn't want her drink. And my dad was, like, you know, just playing bartender and making all these drinks. So I asked my dad if I could have it. And he said, sure. So the next thing I remember, I'm in the living room dancing in a circle to Jimmy Buffett. That my dad and my uncle and my cousin are playing on the guitar. And that was the first time in my life where I didn't have that anxiety. I didn't have that isolation. I felt a part of. I felt like the cutest thing in the world. And no one was going to bring me down. And I was glad to be there. And it was the best time of my life. Until the next morning. And, well, actually afternoon. My cousin woke me up around 1 o'clock in the afternoon saying, your dad wants you in town. And I struggled to get out of bed, and I was not okay. And that was my first hangover. So I had had my first drunk, my first blackout, and my first hangover in a matter of 24 hours at the age of 9. And I had to drive back to town in a restored Chevy Nova with no exhaust. So my head was hurting. I had a hangover. It was the first time I had ever drank, and I vowed, I'm never doing this again. It will not happen. And even before then, like, I had a major affinity to alcohol. Like, my parents had this huge bar that took up, like, half the kitchen. But no one ever drank anything, really. So I would, like, take the bottles, and I would leave the caps on, but, like, pour drinks upside down and make little, like, invisible drinks. And my parents collected the stirrers. So they had, like, this whole little glass of stirrers, and I'd put one in there and say, Mommy, I made you a drink, with, like, nothing in there. But, like, I had this strange affinity to alcohol at quite a young age. So after that, you know, I came back to Virginia, and I had vowed I'm never going to drink again. Like, I've had my first blackout, I've had my first drunk, I've had my first hangover, never again. And for a couple of years, it actually worked. I was on a moral hilltop from everybody else, and I believe that if you drank or if you did drugs, then you were a bad person and you were going to hell. And I firmly stood by that. I did not believe that anyone that drank or did anything like that was a moral person. And, like, I'd never really been raised in religion, so I don't know where this, like, strong idea that you're a bad person came from. But for some reason, like, anybody that did anything that was, like, what I deemed bad, they were a bad person. So I lived like that for a while, and needless to say, I didn't have a lot of friends. Because it's kind of lonely being at the top of that little pole, just condemning everyone else. So I had, like, a couple of friends. Like, I could always manage to hold on to one or two at a time, but I couldn't really juggle more than that. Because I was more like, you were more a victim to me than you were a friend. Like, I would clutch my hands in you, and you would be my, like, Elmira, for example. Like, I will love you and hug you and kiss you and squeeze you and caress you. Like, that was what it meant to be a friend to me. Like, I would just emotionally vampire you. And so I didn't have a lot of friends. But I did have a couple, and the ones that I did have were the same as me. You know, they didn't believe in drinking. They thought the drugs were bad. Like, I was part of the D.A.R.E. program. I put my little promise on the balloon and let it go. You know, I was, like, really big into not doing anything. And, you know, after a while, it just gets really, really bad. When I was about 15 or so, I started acting out in other ways because at this point, like, I didn't really know alcohol was a solution because I didn't really know I had a problem. I just thought that I was right and you were wrong. So that was kind of where I was living at that point. And my friend wanted to go see a boy. So we took her mom's car, and we drove it up and down the road, and we could never find the place, so we went to the Silver Diner in Springfield, and we had milkshakes and stuff, and she didn't know the gas from the brake, so I was really nervous. So I was like, you're not driving, I will be driving, because I've at least driven cars down hills before and stuff, so I'm going to be driving, you're not touching that car. And what ended up happening was I didn't understand hydroplaning. Because I was, like, 14 or so. So I really didn't understand that when it rains, you should really slow down. So I went around a corner a little too fast, 360'd, and drove up a tree. And we kind of jumped out of the car and looked at it, and we're like, this isn't good. And we ended up making it back to her mom's house. And about 20, 30 minutes later, the cops knocked on the door. And they were convinced that I was on something. They thought I was on drugs. They thought I was drinking. They could not believe that someone in their right mind would make a decision like that. And let me tell you, that was, like, not the first or the last time I made a decision like that. Sober or not. And, like, I mean, when I was 4, I drove a car down a hill, over a pear tree, and literally feet away from my pond. And I ran inside, and I was like, Daddy, Daddy, don't look out the window. Don't look out the window. And, of course, he looks out and sees this demo car, like, right into the pond. So those were kind of, like, unmanageable situations that just continuously happened throughout my life. And it turns out that the car was pretty badly damaged underneath, and my friend was like, oh, well, you know, I'm protecting you from my mom taking you to court and suing you. And I was so ungrateful. I was like, you know what? It was your fault to begin with. This was your idea. How am I to blame for any of this? So needless to say, after this kind of attitude, I needed a drink. I needed something, because this was how my life was going, where I was just blaming. I'd already started blaming everyone for everything, and nothing could be my fault, because you were so wrong, and I'm so right. So I met some people when I was around, like, 15 or 16 or so, and they lived in Fort Belvoir. They were Army brats, and so they invited me to a party over at their house, where there was drinking and drugs and stuff. And so I went there because I was like, you know what? I need to fit in somehow. There's got to be some way to, like, break through to the popular circle. Because, you know, I was, like, 200 pounds, and I had, like, a southern accent, so everyone in my school made fun of me because they were like, oh, it's a little country hick. And so I'd, like, cry every day again, still not thinking of a comeback. And so I was like, finally, you know, somebody wants to hang out with me, a group of people want to hang out with me, so this is great. So I went to that party, and I was, like, you know, instantly welcomed, connected, and I felt like that was the first family that I'd ever had. It was the first group of friends or fellowship, and so I constantly party with them. I would go to Fort Belvoir and steal wine coolers out of the bowling alley, refrigerator because, you know, I was like 15, 16, 17 when I was doing this, so not really legal yet. And that was pretty much how I lived for a couple of years. During that time, I started skipping high school a lot. When I was 9 years old, 9 or 10, I guess, I started passing out randomly, and no one really knew why, and they did a lot of tests on me and found out, like, it's something totally different. It had nothing to do with alcohol or drugs at all, but they gave me some medicine for it, and I stopped passing out. But I would still use it to my advantage, especially when I was hungover. I was like, Mom, I feel like I'm going to pass out. And she's like, oh, my God, go back to bed. I don't want you passing out. So I missed about 181 days of high school because I constantly felt like I was going to pass out. When I really didn't, I just felt lazy. And this was part of that 181 days was actually into sobriety. So sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But I played my mom for a long time, and I would get drunk. I would come home and play confessions, like, Mom, I'm a good girl, right? I'm a good daughter. You don't hate me. You love me, right? And my mom had no clue during this entire period that I was doing anything at all. So it was really a shock to her when I was 17 years old, and I was smoking pot in my car with a friend of mine who I worked with. We were going to meet up with some other friends and get drunk. And I ran a yellow light coming out of my neighborhood, and a cop saw me and pulled me over. And I was like, the light was yellow. What the hell? Like, it was yellow. Why am I getting pulled over? And even when I was at the light, I rolled down my window real quick because I was like, my car smells like tot. I can't. I had this impending doom that I was about to get pulled over, and I did. So I kind of, like, aired out my car a little bit, but it wasn't enough because when the cop pulled me over, the first thing he smelled was pot. And he searched my car and asked me if I had anything else, and I was so paranoid, and I had never been in trouble with the law at this point. I was like, I don't have anything else, I swear. And he was more mad that I was driving on a suspended license than the fact that I had been smoking pot in my car. Hence the unmanageability versus ugly head again. And so he allowed me to drive my car home. He called another cop to take my friend back to his house. And so I drove home, and the cop had told me, if my mom is home, which I knew she was, you can stay. But if your mom's not home, you're coming to JDC with me tonight, and you're leaving your car at home. So he walks me down, we knock on the door, and my mom answers the door and sees me with a cop. And my mom has this line in the middle of her forehead when she gets really mad. It's like, her skin just comes together, so it's like the Grand Canyon in her forehead, and that line was there, and the cop explained to her that I had been pulled over driving on a suspended license, and since I was 17, did she not know that she could go to jail for me driving, because she's my guardian, and she was really mad about that too. He also explained that there was marijuana in my car, and she wasn't pleased about that either. And he made some joke about not wanting to come back for a domestic dispute because he saw that same look of anger and rage on my mom's face that I saw. And so he slammed the door behind me. My mom slammed the door behind me, and she was like, I'm so disappointed. I can't even look at you right now. Go to your room, and maybe we'll talk in the morning. And, I mean, up until this point, my mom had been like my grand cheerleader. You know, she had supported me on everything I did. She understood everything I did, or at least tried to understand. Like, when I was 14, I begged her to send me to a psychiatrist because I thought there was something wrong with me. And she was like, you're just a normal teenager. You're fine. I was like, no, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. Like, I need to go to a psychiatrist or something. And she's like, no, you're just a normal teenager. You're just going through, like, all that normal teenage stuff. You're fine. Don't worry about it. So, you know, my mom just figured everything I did was a phase. And at this point, I had met people at the Silver Diner where I had been working. And they came in every single night carrying their cartons of cigarettes and demanding their carafes of coffee. And I would get so angry when they walked past my hostess stand. I was like, who are you to walk past my hostess stand? This is my restaurant. How dare you walk past me? But after talking to them, I found out they were in recovery. And it was like a group of 20 of them every night. They came in approximately 9:40 p.m. And that never really clicked until I started going to meetings. But I knew that, like, the late night people were going to be there. And I ran to them and I told them my sob story of how I got pulled over and there was pot in the car. And how I was driving on a suspended license. And really, the only reason that I talked to them was because I was looking for a solution in order to not get in trouble. Because when I got pulled over that night, I did a foxhole prayer. Like, God, get me out of this one, and I swear I'll go to church. I'll do whatever you want. Just, you know, get me out of this one. And so I met my first sponsor that night, and she told me, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night up the road, and if you want to go, it's cool. If you don't like it and you don't want to come back, your misery can be refunded to you 100% at the door. And I took that as a challenge. I was like, all right, I'm not really miserable. I'll check it out. Because I didn't know that, I didn't know until I experienced an ounce of real happiness how dead I was. And so I went to that meeting the next night. My mom was with me. She's actually been to my first meeting and every anniversary meeting since. She's really big into supporting me here. And I went to the meeting, and there was this really energetic girl who was the chair. And she was, like, bouncing around, setting up chairs. She was like, hi, my name is Rachel. It's so great to meet you. Is this your first time here? And I was just taken aback. I grabbed my mom's arm, and I was like, I can't be here. Oh, my God. I can't stay. And my mom just kind of, like, shuffled me over to a seat, and they asked me to read how it works. And so I read it a little bit before I had to read it out loud, and I had already worked 12 steps right there. I saw the steps, and I was like, powerless, unmanageable, check. Came to believe, check. Will of life over, got it. Ooh, personal inventory. That could be a nugget right there. And for some reason, that fourth step stuck out to me because I had come in hating everybody in the world and thinking that everybody hated me and wondering, why is it like this? Why do I hate so many people, and why do so many people hate me? And I figured that fourth step was going to be my solution to figure out why I was so unhappy with life and why I was so distraught and why I was so lonely, because I really couldn't tell you why. You know, I was the girl in high school that my friends would bring alcohol in their locker, and I was like, what are you doing? That's so bad. You can't do that. But then I would do it, like, a year later, you know? Or I was also, like, the introducer to my friends. Like, oh, you want to go drink? It's really cool. And so I would, like, you know, just bounce back and forth. But at that first meeting, for some reason, like, I saw all of the normal people that were at the Silver Diner there. So I felt a lot more comfortable, and I was able to stay and talk to them, and I ended up going to the Silver Diner with them that night too. And, you know, just talking, my mom talked to a couple of them and tried to find out what the deal was with this whole, like, sobriety recovery thing. And so I stuck around for about 3 days and got a boyfriend. So I stuck around another month. And when that boyfriend was done, I got another boyfriend who ended up getting engaged about 6 months later. But they were the reason that I kept going to meetings. You know, I knew that boyfriend was going to be there, so I'd show up every time. And then when that one boyfriend was done, I found that next boyfriend, and I knew that he was going to be there at every single meeting. I knew my sponsor was going to be at every single meeting. And for some reason, I felt like I was letting people down if I didn't show up. So when I had about, I guess, 2 to 3 weeks, I got a service position as the chair because the original chair stopped showing up. So I was like, I'll do it. I want to be in front of people. I'll do it. I love people paying attention to me. And as the chair, people pay attention. And I, like, just piling on the responsibility and, like, trying to find a good leader and thinking that, like, my meeting's going to be the best meeting in the world. You know, and I guess for someone with 3 weeks, it might be a good attitude to have to at least keep them coming back. But it worked. It kept me coming back because I thought that I was going to have the best meeting and the best leaders and you're going to want to come to my meeting. Because it was still like that 3 or 4 year old mentality of mine, mine, mine. The world centers around me. It's very egocentric. And so, you know, I kept chairing meetings. I picked up more service. I started working the steps with my sponsor. In around 8 months, you know, I had the ring. I had the boyfriend. I still had my car. Like, I was a pretty functional alcoholic. I always kept my job. I always kept a car. And I always had a place to live because my mom was going to throw me out. So, you know, I had a pretty high bottom compared to a lot of people. Most of what I lost was my mom's respect and the respect of people around me. But other than that, like, I didn't really lose much. But it was enough for me to get here and to stay around. But by 8 months, I'd already forgotten why I was here. I totally lost my first step. I was right about to start my fourth step that I was really excited about. But I was asking people, do you think I have a problem? Do you think I should be here? I mean, I am 17. And, I mean, no one in my family really has a problem, right? Because we were just kind of throwing my uncle aside there. And it's probably just a phase, right? Because my mom thought everything in my life was a phase. So I just went with it. Like, it's probably just a phase, right? I mean, there's really nothing wrong. And after polling for months, I finally found one person that said, well, go. Here, go. What's wrong with you? Why poll? Just go find out. There's nothing wrong with finding out. You might need more pain. And I was like, finally, somebody agreed. You know, someone co-signed me saying it's okay to go. Who needs to stay? And so me and my fiancé went to a bar. I was 17, like I said, and I had this idea. This is my third step. All right. So my third step told me that if I was meant to stay sober, I would not get served. But if I was meant to go back out, God would work it, and I would get served. So it would be God's will. That was my idea of God's will at 8 months. So I asked for a drink, and the bartender brought back a drink. And I kind of looked at it for a minute, and I was like, well, here goes. And I took the sip, and it got right to here, and I was like, oh, I just threw away 8 months. I just wasted 8 months of my life. I was here for nothing. And it got down to here, and I was like, 8 months is nothing. So I finished it. And I couldn't drink more. Well, I felt like at the time I couldn't drink more because my fiancé was 24 and I was 17. So I didn't want him getting in trouble for me having alcohol. So I figured, like, you know, eventually he would just buy me alcohol because he had pretty much gone out with me that night. He had taken a sip, too. So, you know, we both relapsed together. And that was like, I guess, August or so. And I was a lifeguard that season. It was pretty fun. I was a sober lifeguard up until that time. And the lifeguards in my work were actually the ones that recommended my drink. So I took up their recommendations because they had been drinking a lot longer than I had. And so I went back to work, and we would pull stuff like closing the pool early so we could go drink down at the other pool because we had two pools in my community. There was the big pool that everyone could go to and then the condo pool that I lived at. So only like the condo residents could go there. And it was never really open, so we could just go there and like keep it closed. So I'd always throw a Slurpee in the pool, a Coke Slurpee because it's brown. And people would drive up and were like, oh, sorry, the pool's closed. There's a little mini accident in the pool. Sorry. Because we didn't believe in Snickers or any of that stuff. We were like, go for the Coke Slurpee. So we would close down the pool, and we would go and do drinking games at the other pool and just kind of lock ourselves in. And on that one particular occasion, one of my friends in recovery came and saw me. And my fiancé had just gotten home, and his best friend was with her because my best friend was dating his best friend. So it was kind of weird. And she came and knocked on the door. She had been, like, calling my cell phone and knocked on the door. And it's like, where have you been? What's going on? And I was like, oh, nothing. I have been drinking so bad. And even, like, I talked to her about it a couple months ago. And she was like, I totally didn't smell alcohol in your breath. I didn't even know you were drunk. But I was drunk. And I was having a full-blown conversation with her about why I wasn't going to meetings anymore and why I really didn't think I needed to go. So from there, I just kept lifeguarding, and my mom had planned a graduation trip for me to go to the Bahamas. So it was my mom, my boyfriend, and I, or fiance, and I, all going to the Bahamas. And so I went down there, and the legal drinking age down there is high enough to see over the bar. So there really is no age. It's just if you look old enough. So as soon as we got off the plane, at the hotel we were staying in, they were giving out free drinks. And they were really, really good. So I would go over there, get three cups, and bring them back. But I would drink mine real quick, go back and get another one, and then say, oh, did you guys want another one too? And just going back and forth and drinking them in between and going back and getting another one and then going back over here. So I drank a lot, like, just after landing in the Bahamas. And, I mean, from that point on, like, they had little swim-up bars, and I would find those, find any cabana boy walking around anywhere. I was like, right here, I need another one, please. bring whatever. And so pretty much that entire trip, I can't really tell you much what that happened, except for I played putt-putt golf, because there's a picture of it. And apparently I saw a stingray from my hotel, because there's a picture of it. But other than that, I don't know anything else that I did, because I was drunk the whole time. My mom had told me, because I had decided that I didn't need to be in recovery anymore, that I could have one drink a day. So I super exceeded that one drink quota a lot every day. And but she still never really thought that I had a problem, because my mom had, like, a best friend in high school that shot up heroin, and her boyfriend was, like, the band guy. And so she was around a lot of the really, really bad drugs. I mean, my mom was born in 49, so she was definitely of age in the hippie time. But in her own daughter, she could not see that I had a problem, because she was in so much denial. So we came back up here, and I went to a meeting that night just to say hi. You know, I had to see my sponsor again, what I claim my sponsor, and just see people just to say hi. So I went to the Saturday night meeting. It ended at 9:30, and I showed up at 9:31. And people were coming outside, and I was like, hi, how are you? My sponsor just kind of looked at her watch and looked at me. It's like, the meeting just ended. It started an hour and a half ago. Hi, what are you doing here? And I couldn't tell you at that point, but I definitely had the alcoholic loneliness, that nobody understood me, and my life was slowly crumbling to bits again. I was slowly coming back down to another bottom, and my fiancé and I kept fighting. He actually moved out because we were fighting all the time. And I, like, if I couldn't find something, like if I had lost something in my stash, I always blamed him. I always thought that he had taken it because I couldn't find it. It couldn't have been that I had been drunk and then misplaced it. It was because he stole it from me. So as soon as I started drinking again, I slipped back into that, like, blame you mentality, and it's all your fault, and it can't be me. You know, I'm perfect. And so after a while, we broke up, but that wouldn't be the last time. And I was pretty sick. But I started getting sober again, because I knew that with him, it was kind of like a dead weight. Because I wanted to drink with him, and I wanted to be a part of his life, but part of me knew that I was dying again. And I was, like, very black on the inside, and I needed something. So I started going back to meetings again, and we were kind of on again, off again, until about November of that year. From, I guess, July to November, we would be together and break up, and be together and break up, and I gave back the ring, and it was just a big, dramatic to-do. But I was in a meeting, and I was sober when we broke up the first time, and I remember sitting on that floor crying, because I couldn't even sit in my seat, because I was just bawling so much, because he was my soulmate, and we were meant to be together. I mean, we met in this God-inspired program. We have to be together. And my friends would just say, you know, it's cool. A, there'll be another one. B, why don't you just focus on recovery instead? So that's what I did. I jumped back into getting, I got a home group again right away. I got that same sponsor back, and I started working the steps. And this time I got to 4, and I saw that I'm a victim. I'm a victim of circumstance, because I like to think that it's all your fault. And so I very clearly saw that it is not necessarily everyone else's fault. I have a part. As much as I don't want to say that, I have a part. And, like, the spiritual axiom, if I'm disturbed, I'm wrong. Well, what am I wrong about? What's my part? What am I doing? And from there, like, I did my 5th step, which was awesome also, because I love talking about me. So I got to sit in my sponsor's bedroom for 8 hours while her boyfriend was bringing up pots of coffee. And we had, like, my little carton of cigarettes right there, and she had her carton of cigarettes, and we have her bedroom window open just smoking and drinking lots and lots of coffee. It was an 8-hour process. But it was cool, like, because I finally got out all the junk, like the resentment against my dad, all the junk that had been, like, sitting inside of me. And kind of going back a little bit, I graduated high school sober before I had relapsed. And so I'm walking into the auditorium, and I see my grandma, I see my mom, I see my sponsor, I see my fiancé, and I see some random old man. And that old man was my dad. I hadn't seen him in 10 years. And, you know, he showed up. And there was a lot of anger and a lot of hatred that was still there. And I hadn't quite gotten my fourth step yet, so I hadn't really gotten it out. But the fact that he even showed up at all after he had been hiding for 10 years was a big deal. And so when I got to that second fourth step, and he's actually been on quite a few because I'm a little bit hard-headed sometimes, and I don't want to let stuff go. But, you know, I had him in a couple of four steps, which means I had to make amends to him later, because on my fourth and fifth step, I didn't understand why I had to make amends to him when he was the one that had done harm to me. And my sponsor pointed out that it was because I was holding on to it, and that was my part, was that I would not let it go. I refused to. It was always his fault. Like, any kind of man situation was his fault. Like, if I couldn't maintain a relationship, or if, like, some boy was treating me bad, it was my dad's fault, and it was, like, the perception that he gave me of men that was why everything was wrong in my life. So I was finally able to, like, see him again and make amends to him. I guess the first set of amends I'll kind of go back to 4 and 5 to do 6 and 7. 6 and 7 were always kind of really hard for me, because whenever I would get on them, I would never really move forward much. I would always just kind of stagnate there, because I didn't really know that you needed willingness to move on. So I just kind of sat on it for a while. And I didn't really know what to do with it, because my sponsor would just say, the willingness will come. And I was like, what am I supposed to do? I'm just sitting here doing nothing. And I was, like, really active in steps. Like, my first sponsor always had me writing. So I felt like that was working steps, was writing. And, making lists and, you know, writing out my first step. And, you know, writing out my belief in a higher power and what it was. And so when I was on 6 and 7, it was really hard because I didn't do anything. So I didn't really know what to do, and I didn't know how I was ready to move on. And eventually, like, the willingness just came. Like, I began to see that, you know, the world and its people may have been quite wrong, but I was far more wrong. And that was something that I really had to come to terms with. And just started seeing all my defects flaring up all over the place and learning how to deal with them. And how to deal with them would be to pray, you know, and ask for their removal. And maybe it's just not time for it yet. You know, maybe that defect is going to help somebody else. And it's going to help me, but, like, asking for its removal. And so I guess the second last time I did my eighth step, because I did them a couple of times just to kind of, you know, reemphasize the amends. But the second to last time I did them, I remember it was around Christmas. It was, like, December or so. And I would sit on it, like, I'm just not willing to make amends again. Just not willing, because, like, the first set of amends I had made, I hadn't really lived up to very well, so it was kind of like, we definitely need to go back and make amends to people. And so I hadn't really lived up to my amends very well, and I was like, you know what, I'm not a different person. How can I go make an amends to someone, which means to change, if I haven't? If I'm the same person that's doing the same scummy stuff over and over and over again. And so after repeated prayer and repeated talking to my sponsor and trying to figure out what to do, one day it was just like, you know what, I think I'm ready. You know, I think I just need to go talk to my mom. And it happened to be on Christmas. You know, so I made amends to my mom on Christmas. And I made amends to my grandma. The first time I made amends to her, she said, it's about time. So it's one of those, like, you don't really expect it to happen that way, but it did. Because I totally thought my grandma would, like, be on board, like, yeah, that's great, you're sober. My son was a drunk, you know. But she was like, it's about time. And that kind of floored me. But she, I did actually owe her a lot of money, because I would go to community college and not actually go. Like, she would give me money, and I'd tell her it's about $5,000 a semester when it's really, like, $30 credit. And so that's a lot of money. And I would withdraw from classes and then just go shopping or pay my bills or something. So I owed her a lot of money for school, and she said, you know what, that was a gift to you. Don't worry about paying that back. So as of right now, like, my sponsor and I are okay with me not paying it back because I have no income. So, but my amends to my dad was, like, one of the big ones that meant a lot to me because I'd finally been able to let go of all that hatred and all that blame because it was just, like, piling up in me. And it still comes back a little bit. Like, I was at a retreat last year, and the topic was forgiveness. And I'd come to realize that I hadn't fully forgiven him as much as I thought I had. So, you know, it's kind of like peeling back the onion. There's still that little bit left. And so when I made amends to my dad, it was really just trying to be a daughter in his life. You know, trying to call him on his birthday and holidays, say happy birthday, happy holidays, and kind of invite him into mine and allow him to be a father in my life. And I was able to go down there and see him about 7 years ago, and then I went again this summer to go see him and my granddaddy and just kind of hang out and be a part of the family and, you know, let him be a father to me. Because that was a big thing that, like, I felt like I didn't have a father for years because my dad just wasn't there. So, and then later on, my amends to my mom were kind of redone in a way. Like, I've pretty much always lived with my mom, except for, like, a couple months where I lived with an ex-boyfriend. But about two or three years ago, she had a pretty bad heart attack where she had cardiogenic shock on the table, and they didn't think she was going to live. Like, all of her organs shut down, and it was a pretty bad situation. She was in a medicated coma for 6 weeks after that. And they weren't sure whether she was going to live. And the only thing that I could do was just show up to the hospital every single day for at least a couple minutes to a couple of hours and just hold her hand and say, I'm here. Because the first time when I was 14 that she had her first heart attack, I refused to show up. So it's like, I don't want that mental image of my mom in my head with tubes on her arms and, like, in her nose. I just don't want that. And I was such a selfish person. I could not show up for my mom after she'd been there for so much for me. And so... You know, that last time I showed up for her and I was there every single day. You know, I would go to the hospital without fail. And finally, you know, she woke up after 6 weeks and she had no clue what had happened. She lost 6 weeks of her life and I was there to take care of her and to show up for her and do anything that she needed. Like, I would go get the nurse for her, I'd go get the doctor, I'd call my grandma, you know, I would do anything that she needed. And that's part of the reason I still live with her today is because while she is, like, 98% recovered, there's still some things. So I'm able to live with her and help her, like, just open a bottle of water, you know, because she lost a lot of strength, so she can't open it. So I'm able to just open a bottle of water for her, you know, and, you know, let her make me dinner because that's all she wants to do. She wants to feel like a normal person again after going through months of therapy. She just wants to make dinner, you know. She just wants to do my laundry. And that's stuff that I just let her do because it's what she wants to do. I feel like such a selfish person saying, like, my mom does my laundry. But it's what she wants to do. She just wants to feel normal again. And, you know, the minute that she complains about it, I will totally do it. But as of right now, she's like, she wants to feel like, you know, she's recovered and that she's a normal person in society again instead of, you know, some, like, other health problems and stuff. So... You know, that was, like, a major way I was able to show up for my mom because after all that she had done for me, I felt like the least I could do was show up to the hospital and take care of her. It was the least I could do. The fact that she stuck around me with the cops coming home, well, that one time, and, you know, like, my crazy friends that I brought over or just the situations that I would put her in. Like, she could have gotten to jail for me driving on a suspended license, but... just the least I could do is finally show up for her and show her that I love her and I do care and I do appreciate everything she does. And now we have a great relationship. You know, my mom is probably one of my best friends and I tell her everything. Like, I pretty much tell anybody everything. My life is an open book. It's like an open fifth step. I don't care. You know, there are no secrets with me. So, you know, I made those amends and then 10, 11, and 12, like, for a long time, with my 10th step, I didn't really have a God. And I know that kind of goes back to 1 or 2 and 3, but I didn't know what I was praying and meditating to. I didn't know what I was writing my inventories to. I just kind of sat there like, all right, what is this? Some omnipotent being that I don't know about that's not physically present. So for a long time, like, I had been raised pretty non-religious. Like, I went to Baptist church 4 times in my life. And then I moved up to Virginia, and all my friends were like, oh, come to Catholic church with me. Oh, come to Christian church with me. Oh, come to my Jewish temple or my synagogue. Oh, come to my Buddhist temple, you know. Oh, do you want to be Wiccan? So I had, like, different kinds of religions thrown at me, and every god just didn't seem right. It seemed very similar to my childhood god that was very vengeful, very vindictive, and very spiteful, kind of like me. And so, you know, I'm like trying to pray and meditate and write my inventories to this like crazy, vindictive, spiteful being, and it never occurred to me until I had like at least a year or so that I could change my higher power. And my heart, like, I ran my head into a wall so many times because I would, you know, judge all the religious people and their Sunday best. And, you know, condemn them. And, like, I actually study the Reformation. That's what I'm in school for, basically. So looking at, like, the religious side of both of them, I'm like, how could people do this? And, you know, freaking out about that. And never really looking at the fact that I could choose my own higher power. And my first sponsor told me, well, you know what? That doorknob over there is going to be your higher power. I was like, it's a doorknob. What? Like, what's a doorknob going to do? And she's like, well, that doorknob can open the door and you can't, right? And I was like, true. Good point. Touche. So the doorknob became my higher power. And then I got this idea of, like, nature, because trees can grow, grass can grow, wind can blow, it can rain, and I have nothing to do with it. So it is a power greater than myself. So I made nature my higher power. So I feel like it's always around me. My higher power is always with me. It's just kind of this idea that I have, so I feel more at ease and more comfortable. And so it made it a lot easier to write my inventories and pray and meditate, because then I knew what it was. I had some sort of idea that it was around me at all times. You know, even just the air in the room, it's still here. And so I was, you know, that was my confusing story on religion versus spirituality. And, because, I mean, I came out with this crazy god, and that was where my sponsor pointed out, it's not about your crazy god that you think you had in religion. Religion has nothing to do with this program. It's all about spirituality. And I was like, oh, well, that makes sense then. So I kind of took it off the Wiccan stuff. I was like, oh, well, they believe in nature, so here we go. They don't believe in, like, necessarily God. It's more spirit. So I was like, there we go. We can make some connections here. And practicing these principles in all my affairs has definitely been very hard, because I am by nature a pretty negative person. I still like to blame, not necessarily to the extent I did before, but I have tendencies of getting angry and overreacting. And generally, like, I try to talk to people about it, like, this is how I want to react. I know it's not the right way to overreact, but this is how I want to react. Just so I can tell someone and kind of, you know, tattle on myself, because I have a tendency to just blow things out of proportion and take people's inventories and all that good stuff. And so I tend to talk to one of my pigeon sisters or my sponsor and kind of tell myself, like, this is what I want to do. This is how I'm not going to be practicing these principles in all my affairs. And so that way I can actually take the right action, because intuitively I know that what I'm thinking is wrong. Like, yelling at someone and taking their inventory is not the appropriate way to handle a situation. But that is not always the switch that goes on first. So then we have to promptly go back and make amends and take care of all of it, kind of sweep it aside, hopefully, and make it all right. But you know, helping other people and practicing these principles, like, I try my best, and that's all I can really do. You know, I call my sponsor pretty much every day. I talk to her pretty much every day. And just tell her the deal and be as honest as humanly possible. Like, there was a point in my sobriety where, like, a couple of months ago, actually, I started getting so resentful again and just so angry that I had to do another fourth step, because there were things on there that were silly. They were just so silly and so small, but in my head, they were huge. And it was affecting me, like, helping other people was affecting me, practicing these principles in all my affairs, because I would just look at people thinking they're on the attack, you know, and projecting my fears onto them, thinking they're going to attack me, they're going to do something to me. And so my first reaction is to attack them first or to build up a wall, either one. And so I asked my sponsor, hey, you know, can I do another inventory? I think I really need to do another fourth step, because some of the things on there are just so crazy. And I would put them on paper, and it would be like five little words. That's it. I had like 100 spinning in my head in a constant whirlwind circle, and there's five little words on a piece of paper. I was like, these five words are what's been driving me crazy for so long. Like, just these tiny little words. Like, she stole my sponsor. You know? Like, that was one of them. Like, that's it? You know? And it was getting that stuff out that finally got me to the point of, like, feeling a lot more open again and, you know, feeling like I can help people in sobriety and I can, you know, try to practice these principles in all my fears. And, yeah, I'm still working on the gut reaction of, like, defense, you know, and, like, being angry and being feisty, or, as Joni and I like to call it, the arbiter of justice. But, you know, it's definitely, after talking to her and, like, learning and making sure that I'm doing my daily meditation and my 10 steps, making sure that, you know, I read On Awakening and learn how to pause and ask for the next right action and intuitively have it in my gut, because otherwise, I'm just crazy. You know, I'm like a dry alcoholic. And who wants a dry alcoholic? They're crazy people. I'm a crazy person, you know? And, you know, just living that kind of lifestyle, because it gets painful, and that's when we want to drink, you know, when we get in that kind of pain. And I don't want to be like that anymore. You know, I don't want to be in that kind of lifestyle. I like the life that I have today. I've been able to do things sober that I never thought, you know, never thought. Like, you know, I got to travel to Italy and Belize, and I studied abroad in Oxford. You know, like, I couldn't even make it in college, and I got to study abroad in Oxford. Like, that's a sober dream, and I'm actually getting ready to graduate in a couple months and finally get out and start teaching. You know, those are amazing gifts of sobriety that I never really thought I wanted before. Like, I was a kid that would sit in my bedroom looking at all these travel places and not really being able to go because none of my friends wanted to go, or I just couldn't get the money, or, you know, you can't really drive in Ireland until you're 25, and I was 17, so, you know, that kind of threw a wrench. But, like, I got to do things in sobriety and never thought were possible. And the fact that I even have an ounce of serenity today, an ounce of compassion, or an ounce of tolerance for other people is a far cry from where I was when I came in here. Because I was definitely not able to be a friend when I got here. And not able to be a productive member of society when I got here. And now, like, people in my school, like, I told everyone when I went to Oxford, I don't drink. And they were like, how do you have so much fun without alcohol? How is that possible? And, you know, it's things like that. It's like, I don't need to drink to have fun, you know? Just being sober is a lot of fun. And, you know, just finding other ways to make it okay. So with that, I am, like, 2 minutes away, but I feel like if I get into something else, we're going to drag it out. So thanks for letting me share.